Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warriors Radio Network.
I'm friends with the monster that's under my bed. Get along with the voices inside of my head. You're trying to save me, stop holding your breath. And you think I'm crazy, yeah, you think I'm crazy.
All right, let me tee this up for you, and we're gonna fast forward a little bit in it. They normally have some moderator that comes on, and
more nukes.
This dude right here, yeah, he's an Army guy, and he's trying to be funny, but he's really not. Okay, so he introduces the person that's going to be the moderator. All right, so we'll hear from her. She'll introduce kind of the panel. And I'll tell you what, in my opinion, an extremely, extremely interesting discussion about Russia, present-day Russia, what Putin's trying to do with it, how Russia operates, and from a very, very interesting panel. So don't touch that dial. You'll get smart. Yeah, you'll be the smartest person you know about Russia here in about 55 minutes.
That I know that she works for GQ, I'm even hoping for a few style tips. My expectations are very high, and I'm certain that they're going to be met. So please join me in a warm welcome for Ms. Yaffe and the rest of the panel.
I mean, I still live in D.C., so I don't know about style tips. Thank you so much for having us at this beautiful dork summer camp. We're no Kirstjen Nielsen, but I think this is going to be an amazing panel given how much we've been talking about Russia the last 2 days. To my left is Nina Khrushcheva, who is the great-granddaughter of Nikita Khrushchev, but more importantly, she's a professor of international studies at the New School in New York. To her left is Andrew Weiss, who is a vice president at the Carnegie Endowment. And he runs all the Russia-Eurasia research out of Moscow and Washington. And last, but certainly not least, is Victoria Nuland, the former Assistant Secretary of State for Europe and Eurasia, and currently the CEO of the Center for New American Security. So I want to talk a bit more about all the, right now we don't have any crazy Andrea Mitchell style breaking news. The breaking news this morning has nothing to do with Putin. Thank God. So I wanted to start by asking kind of the biggest question, and this is to any of you, whoever wants to jump in. Why is Donald Trump so nice to Vladimir Putin? Why is he so seemingly so obsessed with him?
Okay. Shall I go?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, there, as we know, and others would continue with this, the many theories that Putin may have a lot of dirt on Donald Trump. And if Putin is known to be an equal opportunity offender, if DNC was hacked, that probably RNC was hacked and other documents may have been hacked. But in my job as a professor at the New School, I teach propaganda, so I do look at kind of dictatorial, autocratic type of policies. And what I've learned over the years is that autocrats like autocrats. They deal with them better. They understand them better. They subscribe to the same kind of view of the world, that they're on top of it and the rest is nothing. And Trump does like this kind of leadership, this kind of people. Remember when Trump met with Kim Jong-un, one of the comments that he made is that, well, when he talks, Kim Jong-un talks to his people, they sit and listen. When Putin talks to his people, they sit and listen. And Trump does like that. There's not all this pesky democracy and conversation going on. So I think that actually, I mean, somehow in our very invigorated and sometimes like a hysterical debate on both sides about Russia and the U.S., we forgot there was this incredible study of criminology was done all through the Cold War, and they were people like George Kennan, they were people like Robert Tucker, who studied psychology of Soviet leaders, and they were not wrong in figuring out certain traits. And I do think that there is about time now to slightly calm down and really figure out what kind of type of personality these people have. And in fact, it could be just that simple. It could be Donald Trump likes Vladimir Putin because he has this incredible steely gaze.
I could just build on that quickly. We're all addressing what is one of Washington's longest running mysteries, and no one really knows the answer, obviously. But for the better part of 20 years, Donald Trump has been chasing after Vladimir Putin. As a businessman, he tried multiple times to kind of make it in Russia. Didn't work out. As a presidential candidate, I think he spoke in a way that was very provocative, in ways that were completely out of sync with sort of bipartisan views of Russia that date back last 15 so years. And the question was why? Like, what's the upside? Part of it, and this is just me conjecturing, was that no one really, at least of all Donald Trump himself, thought they were going to win. And so they saw potential upside, commercial upside, in the wake of a failed presidential bid. There were a lot of hangers-on and sort of groupies in the Trump campaign who, as we see from all the stuff that's come out, you know, were approached by Russian officials or people connected to the Russian government who also seemingly thought there was something in it for them after the campaign. And a lot of people, I think, never thought they would be held accountable after the election for what happened. So the question now is, you know, I think these are really squarely within Robert Mueller's mandate. Did any U.S. persons break the law? Are there longstanding or, you know, serious counter-espionage and counterintelligence issues that need to be evaluated? Everyone here who's heard FBI Director Wray or Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein's comments sees that there's a lot of real serious stuff going on that the Russians are pushing. It's happening not just in the United States. The previous panelists talked about what's going on in Europe. It's a part of a bigger global pattern. It's not just all about Donald Trump.
Toria? Just picking up on what Nina and Andrew have said, I think, you know, the worrisome thing, particularly of Nina's analysis, that President Trump's actually more comfortable with autocrats, and you see it in the juxtaposition of the way he treated our NATO allies and his continued beating on Germany and Canada and pretty much everybody that we've been allied with and that we have mutual security treaties with, and then the fawning treatment of everybody from Kim Jong-un to Putin, is that it is this feeling of constraint with liberalism. You know, when you have to, in a democratic society, work with your Congress, you have to stay within judicial rule of law, you have to submit to the scrutiny of the Fourth Estate, the free media. You don't just get up in the morning and decide if you're making the deal or you're not making the deal, and self-justify when you make a mistake without anybody questioning you. So, you know, I think the worrisome part here is twofold. First of all, have we analyzed appropriately whether our elected president is actually committed to the constitutional principles and the laws that undergird the United States and to 70 years of treaty history, which has kept us safe and prosperous? Or is he more interested in taking the United States in a one-man rule direction? That's one question. The second question is Vladimir Putin, who, as Nina has said and Andrew has said, is, you know, if nothing else, still very good at the skills that he learned as a young KGB plebe of analyzing the other guy and finding his or her weaknesses and playing to them. So clearly, whatever else happened in that two-hour one-on-one, President Putin played on this sense of colossus constraint that Trump feels and offered him a number of probably cruddy deals and made them sound fabulous as a way of getting out of the constraints of the bureaucracy that the president probably felt as he was getting briefed on the way into Helsinki. And, you know, Putin is the master of offering you a rusty old Lada car in exchange for your Cadillac and calling that a good deal. And if you don't actually know the mechanics, you might fall for it. So it's worrisome both in terms of where the president's concept of what the United States of America is and what the presidency is within the three branches of government, but it's also worrisome in terms of the ability of guys like Putin and Kim Jong-un to manipulate that desire to be an equal opportunity autocrat.
So yesterday we learned, along with DNI Coates, that Trump had invited Vladimir Putin to the White House this fall. And on Monday, although it seems like it was about a year ago, the two of them met in Helsinki and had this kind of black box meeting and then this very strange, a nearly hour-long press conference. To the people who, to the kind of the non-specialists, the people in the general American public, why is that a problem? Why is meeting Vladimir Putin a problem? Why not engage? Isn't talking better than not talking? Because I feel like to a lot of people are freaking out over this. Sounds like we are upset that the guest is using the wrong fish fork at a fancy dinner. So if you, is there a way to explain it to people?
Look, 32-year career diplomat, I always believe that talking is better than not talking. I think it was important for these guys to sit down. I'm actually in the minority in thinking that perhaps having a do-over summit in the fall might be an opportunity for us to get it right. I think the problem here was lack of preparation and the fact that there were no witnesses to validate what was agreed or what wasn't agreed. So now we have a series of Russian assertions, everything from a plan on Syria to a plan on a joint working group on arms control that the Russians are spinning out with no American reaction. And it's certainly in the context of presidential summits never a good idea to do more than a short one-on-one. I mean, leaders often want to talk about their political constraints one-on-one, but there should be a witness in this context. You know, I think the main problem with all of this was that President Trump, if he'd chosen to embrace it, actually walked into the Helsinki summit stronger than an American president has been in a long time. Rising defense budgets, a NATO summit despite the president's effort to spoil it rhetorically, that actually produced rising defense budgets by all NATO allies and new commands, as Mike Murphy was talking about, and a stronger posture. The Russians, by contrast, are broke, and Vladimir Putin is broke, which is why he's raising pensions, why he's raising the VAT tax. We had a lot of ability and can again in November to walk into a summit with Vladimir Putin well-prepared and cut some deals, offer some deals, but on terms that demand that Russia come back into civilized behavior if it wants to work with us. Just one example, and then I'll shut up here. You know, the Russians desperately need and want an extension of the New START treaty.
This is really interesting stuff in terms of, you know, we talk about Russia being their economy being smaller than the Canadian economy. Yet, you know, if you could liken Russian to a bodybuilder that's very top heavy, right? They've got this overblown military. There's not a whole lot behind it, and there's not a whole lot holding it up. And so you'll hear her analysis of where this is the game that Reagan played with Gorbachev. You're going to lose. And why certain treaties are important, and why at least she believes that Russia is doing things in one part so that they can then negotiate them away because it strengthens their critical vulnerability, if you will, which is their economic base.
That was cut in the Obama administration. It expires in 2021. We don't need it as badly. The Russians need it because they don't want to have to spend money building the next generation of ICBMs. We've put money in the budget to do that if we need to. At the same time, Vladimir Putin is violating an 80s treaty on intermediate range nukes. He's building new intermediate range nukes. There's a straight trade to be had. You come back into compliance with the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Agreement, and we can talk about extending New START. And that could have been done in a presidential one-on-one with a little bit of preparation, and there are plenty of other things we can do in the arms control arena. So I believe in talking, but I believe in going in from a position of strength and knowing what it is that the United States needs to defend our people, which, after all, is the president's first job.
Andrew, Nina, care to weigh in?
Just a little thing. I think completely agree with Victoria that talking is better than not talking. I think what struck me, especially coming out of the Soviet Union, I am the former Soviet among these people, it does seem that Donald Trump was went into the meeting, went into the summit on behalf of Donald Trump. And I think that was probably the most shocking revelation, because Putin, however autocratic he may be, actually went there on behalf of Russia. And that flip-flop was just, for all of us watching this, seemed like we are in some surreal universe.
The only thing I'd add to that is that there's a lot of risk dispersed across the breadth of the U.S.-Russian relationship. Right now, there's basically zero trust among the career folks on both sides. And we've had incidents most recently.
You mean U.S. to Russia? U.S. to Russia, you mean? The career level?
Yeah. No, on both sides. There's practically, you know, trust is just non-existent. And then we've had some really bad flashpoint incidents. On February 7th, there was this incident in Syria where we understand, you know, perhaps a couple hundred Russian contract soldiers who are kind of a deniable but, you know, still instrument of the Russian state tried to test our resolve in Syria and attacked a place where U.S. Special Operations Forces were deployed, and they paid a very heavy price for that. But there's just a lot of danger embedded in this relationship. So I agree with Toria that talking is good. The goal should be to put guardrails on what is going to be a largely adversarial or competitive relationship. And this administration should be judged on, do they manage the relationship effectively, not do they make these grandiose promises about how we're going to get along and how we're all going to kind of turn the page about the bad stuff that's happened. The bad stuff is real, and it's going to have a lasting, corrosive effect on this relationship.
So my next question actually dovetails with that. You know, I think in the media it was framed as Putin won Helsinki. So if he won Helsinki, who lost? And the kind of second question to that is, what are the practical consequences of Helsinki? Okay, that was a crazy thing to watch, but are there any practical consequences that are going to come out of that summit?
I'd say the first person to say that Putin, you know, way outperformed, I think, more than he would have liked. You know, Donald Trump basically set himself on fire. Putin tried really hard to, you know, sort of say he was tough on Crimea, and, you know, he was trying to do things to help compensate for Trump's just, you know, wild man performance. But in the end, you know, Putin's, you know, behavior and his maladroit effort to deny that Russia had interfered in our election, to deflect this with this crazy proposal that, you know, he was going to, you know, offer up the 12 GRU intelligence officials who've been indicted by the Mueller team. All that, I think, just in some ways has, you know, catalyzed what Putin wants least, which is another round of sanctions. So there's now moves in the Senate and the House to move a new sanctions package forward. So, you know, in some ways, Russia has become even more toxic. And if, you know, if the opening statements that Putin and Trump had delivered, which were generally, you know, very kind of statesmanlike and sort of addressed a lot of what Toria was describing, if that's where the thing had ended, you know, they would both be in a very different position today.
Yeah. Toria, what do you think?
You know, I think that Putin did not get the Donald Trump that he needed to make Russia great again. You know, he wants to get back to this great superpower negotiation, like in the old days, where we decide the fate of the rest of the world together. That requires a strong, leaderly American with whom you can cut deals. When in the middle of the press conference our president embarrassed himself and embarrassed us, he just ended up looking weak, which doesn't give Trump that partner that he can show his people is worthy of a great Russia, which is why I think you see Putin trying to help Trump out during the press conference a little bit. And as Andrew said, you know, I think they've been dismayed, obviously, that the president is constrained by the three branches of government and checks and balances that we have in our system, that, you know, soon after he was elected, the Congress legislated the sanctions so that he couldn't just lift them unilaterally. And these additional constraints just encourage them to think that he's weaker than he was before. But I think in terms of what Europeans and some of us in the biz were worried about, the president giving away in the one-on-one, either recognizing Crimea on the spot or saying we're going to get out of Syria and leave the Russians to manage the Iranians, you know, that's another cat canary issue, or anything else. Luckily, it wasn't substantive enough that there was much irrevocable there in terms of U.S. policy position that I could see.
And Nina, excuse me, you've pointed out, you made a really good point, that traditionally especially in regards to the, you know, election meddling. Putin has tried to keep himself at a distance and say we never interfere in the internal affairs of another country. But in Helsinki, he said, yes, I did. I wanted him to win. And he inserted him square into the center of American politics. Why did he do that, and what does it mean?
That's what I was actually going to follow up on what Andrew and Victoria said, because I completely agree that that side of Putin, the grand statesman that has been in power for 18 years, certainly was dominating. But there's another part of Putin whom we always studied and discussed, the Putin, the old KGB hand, the operative who was positioned in Eastern Europe, in Germany, in East Germany, the man who saw how East Germany or how the Kremlin, the Gorbachev, Mikhail Gorbachev's Kremlin, gave up on all the work that KGB ever did. And I think that these two Putins keep struggling, because on one hand, he really wanted to, he was a statesman, and that's his Crimean talk, but on the other hand, I've been studying Putin for that 18 years, and he had a blast. I mean, he didn't expect Donald Trump to fold that easily, but he could not have not felt complete satisfaction is that, look, I told you those Americans are idiots. I'm just showing to you how idiotic they are. And I think this kind of two tensions between the Putin, who is on top of the Kremlin and on top of 11 time zones, which is the size of Russia, and Putin, who still nurses this small man, 5'7 height, the small man, little pet peeves, I don't think they could be separated. And whoever does American foreign policy in the future have to remember that these tensions are always present.
Yeah. It's a fellow Russia watcher said that what was amazing about Helsinki was that was watching Vladimir Putin not being able to contain his glee, even though he's usually so good at containing his glee.
Exactly. And also his boredom, because he was like, why are you folding so easily? And I think that's why he inserted himself into that American debate, precisely to see how he can up that game, because he's a grand gambler. We've seen it with Crimea, we saw it in Syria, we saw it in Georgia, we saw it with meddling. He's a really high-stakes gambler.
This is Nikita Khrushchev's granddaughter. Her name is Nina Khrushcheva, right? Professor of International Affairs at the New School. Okay, so she's a very interesting woman, because she grew up in the Soviet Union. So her perspective I found very interesting.
And I think that was one of the gambles, to see whether he can actually put an even broader wedge into the relationship with Europe, relation with the United States. And in some ways, it is also very Russian. You kind of build with one hand and you kill it with another. Mm. But that's that whole 11 time zones, you East and West kind of struggling for its own personality.
Can I just point out the artful use of the double negative by Nina, which is not grammatical, but he could not have. Wait a minute.
But so, okay, so he took this gamble. He drove an even bigger wedge into American politics. What could be, can we game this out? What could be, does it, like Andrew said, make Russia more toxic in America and hamper Trump in making a deal with Russia in the future?
I think, well, the question really is, does Russia want these big deals, or do they want to keep watching the unraveling of the U.S.-led international system? I personally think that's the game here. The stakes are not about can we resolve the INF treaty, or can we do something incremental on the long-running conflict in Ukraine, or these issues. This is about, you know, basically creating a, you know, a vision of the United States and sort of helping the United States president, who's alienating our longest-standing allies, who's blowing up the international trading system, and who's making the U.S. toxic. And I think that's a gift which, you know, the Russians' primary concern all along has been that people like Toria were engaged in a policy of promoting regime change. And that was, for them, this existential concern. And they have responded asymmetrically to it since 2011, 2012. They've convinced themselves of that. They see this threat. They believe that the U.S. deep state that people keep talking about was coming for them. And so now Donald Trump has taken that totally off the table.
Yeah.
So they've got a much freer hand.
So it's not even about sanctions at this point.
I think that would be a nice to have if it's on offer, but this is much more about the, you know, preservation of their regime and their safety.
But also just one thing, absolutely, I don't think it's that much about the sanctions. I also think that Putin is a global splinter, and now he's probably a global hammer more than just a splinter. And it also, that disarray works for him because the European allies, they're so freaked out, please forgive this word, by Trump, by this agent of chaos, that Emmanuel Macron, I think he has been in Moscow, in Russia, 5 times in the last 2 months. So they are clearly building some sort of relationship out there because the hard-on Putin is still more familiar entity than completely unpredictable Trump. So that's also Putin's game, I think, to some degree.
And just to build on that, Putin's also making himself the indispensable man in the Middle East, with Syria being ground zero, where we've had 8 trips by Netanyahu to Russia because he can't count on the United States to keep Iran off of his border. The Jordanians and the Turks and everybody else. Although I think, yes, it is important for Putin's view that he can now not only contest for dominance of the neighborhood around him as he wanted in his earlier terms, but also he can contest who gets to run the global system and offer, along with Xi Jinping, an alternative autocratically dominated model, and he thinks that he is being successful at that. But I don't think it solves Vladimir Putin's problem inside Russia. He does need sanctions relief. He does need investment. He does need more relief from the international isolation that was applied both for the interference in elections and for Ukraine. And without that, he's not going to be able to provide for his people. He's now on his, 4th term, 18th term, and he's built himself into a set of golden handcuffs where Russia desperately needs reform, but he can't reform without giving up some political power, which is unacceptable. And so he needs money to support this kleptocratic model. And if Russia's not starting to grow and produce, and it's growing a little bit more, but not at the level, and as I said, if they're having to raise pension age, raise taxes, they've run through half of the sovereign wealth that they gained during the oil boom period. Yes, maybe at $60, $70 a barrel on oil, he can float for a little time, but he can't continue in a country that is now saying that what it cares about most is whether its hospitals are working. He can't continue to feed his people on this nostalgic glory without the pie growing a little bit.
Yeah, and we'll get back to the internal conditions in Russia, but I wanted to ask you, Toria, because I think this question comes up a lot when we talk about Russian interference in our election. It's the whataboutism that we hear not just from Russia, but also from some quarters in the U.S., which is, well, haven't we meddled in the internal affairs and elections of other countries? And, are we just getting...
Now, this is me. I've said this, right? We meddle in the internal affairs of others. Listen to the answers. I found the answers very interesting to me.
As good as we gave, and as Nina pointed out before the panel, you are still kind of a boogeyman in Russia for, your role on the Euromaidan, and do you think that the U.S. is at all responsible for...
Now, if you don't remember this woman... I want to say she went to something in Kiev, in the Ukraine, and she made a statement that sent Vladimir Putin through the roof, and it had to do with regime change in Russia, okay? And I think that's why I remember her, okay? So her answers are interesting, but they'll all answer the question, and what they do is they look at people like me and say, you're trying to... you're trying to create moral equivalence between these two, and there is none. So have a listen.
For what happened in 2016?
I think it is a false equivalency of the kind that Putin excels at. Since the 60s, we have not put our hands...
And again, Victoria Nolan, former Assistant Secretary of State for Europe and Eurasian Affairs, okay? She just said, since the 1960s, we have not put our hands... on the internal affairs, so she'll go on and expound on that.
On the scale in an election, what we do through the National Endowment for Democracy, through IRI and NDI, is offer political training to all political parties. In fact, in the early days in Moscow, we offered a huge amount of political training to United Russia Putin's party, as well as to the communists and anybody else who wanted it. How do you, in a new, and we do this particularly in new democracies, and it's an equal opportunity thing that we do. But we are not running malign influence campaigns. We are not creating bots that look like human beings and create false TV advertising about opposition candidates. We are not throwing money into elections. You know, it might have been a technique in the deep Cold War, but it certainly isn't now. So, and you know, in the Ukraine context, it's important to remember how the Ukraine crisis starts. Ukraine had been for 3 years negotiating not membership with the European Union, but association. So the ability to have free trade and free travel. And it was when the Russians woke up to that and decided that there was a zero-sum relationship, that it couldn't be a win-win for Ukraine to be closer to Europe and Russia to be closer to Ukraine, that it had to be either or, and insisted and pressured Yanukovych to break that relationship with the EU.
Interfering
in their domestic politics into something that had been agreed and Yanukovych had been elected on, in fact, that, you know, 250,000 Ukrainians go into the streets to protest. And they were not saying, we want a bad relationship with Russia. They were saying, we want a good relationship with the European Union. And so, you know, we get into it when that situation of months and months of protest begins to get violent. And what we were trying to do was help Yanukovych out of the corner he painted himself into by helping negotiate a technical government, half opposition, half Yanukovych's people, that could take them to elections, and then they could have sort of a do-over on their own politics. And we were also talking to Moscow about the notion that if Ukraine had free trade with the European Union and Moscow didn't, there might be a way to have some benefits for Moscow in its free trade with Ukraine. But the Kremlin wasn't buying any of it. They could only see it through zero-sum lenses. So that's, I think, one of the fundamental problems in negotiating with Vladimir Putin. It's hard to paint him a win-win that he will accept.
The one thing I would say, which is a slightly different spin, is that the tactics that have been used in the United States were honed and perfected in Russia's neighborhood. And so what happened in Ukraine in the run-up to the violence in Maidan and then the revolution of dignity in February 2014 and then the attacks on American public officials like Tory Mullen,
yeah,
and the hack and release and all this stuff, yep, that is the playbook that was then extended toward us and accelerated after 2014. And that is a question, I think, for history of, you know, did people not understand how much our own society had become badly polarized and that it would create such a fertile ground for these tools? Because I think all of us would have thought.
The guy who's talking, his name is Andrew Weiss. He's Russia was in his portfolio when he was a member of the National Security Council.
Oh, our media is surely not going to fall prey to being led by the nose. But in reality, you know, we've seen in the Mueller indictments that, you know, they basically handed off a huge amount of data. They doxed, you know, the Clinton campaign. They doxed the DNC. And the American news media and the international media all kind of were parties of that. So, you know, we, you know, have a lot of, I think, questions about resilience and hardening ourselves going forward. And we shouldn't have any, I think, false pride that we're somehow not going to be vulnerable again.
Right. And to add on to that, I remember in 2014, Maxim Trudolyubov actually wrote about how all of these tactics we were seeing in Ukraine had actually been honed at home in Russia against the Russian opposition.
Yes. I was actually quite worried in 2016 what the Russians were very good at doing at home was doctoring email. So you take an existing email, you doctor it to look pretty dirty and nasty, and then you release it, and it takes a while for people to realize that it's been doctored. So, you know, that was actually one of the few techniques that they didn't use
yet. I'm going to ask you one more question, Toria, also a kind of what about us question, but this time not from Putin, but from Trump. You know, Trump keeps saying that the interference happened under the Obama administration's watch. You were still in the administration at that point. And that actually the Trump administration's policies on Russia have been much tougher than the Obama administration's policies against Russia. Is he right?
Well, obviously, the hacking happened on the Obama administration's watch. The president was aware of what was happening and did some public warnings, but made a decision not to react until after the election because, for a variety of reasons, including the intelligence was incomplete until too late, which I blame on us and needs to be corrected. But also, you remember that candidate Trump was already, as early as late July of 2016, saying, this election's going to be rigged, it's going to be stolen from me, et cetera. So I think the president, which is a very Putin-esque technique, right, blame the other guy for, anyway. And so I think President Obama was concerned about this, about any perception that he himself had put his finger on the scale, and thought that we could deal with this after the election, ordered in December a full review of what we knew and put down the first tools of response, the economic and personnel sanctions and taking away the dachas and all that. But I think throughout the U.S. government, regardless of party, there was an expectation that when President-elect Trump was briefed on what had actually happened, that his response would be the normal one of any president: this is an attack on the United States. I need to redouble the efforts that were begun in the Obama administration to address this. And what worries me is in this whole conflating, as Nina said, of personal fate with the fate of the nation, we have lost 18 months where the president should have been first standing up and then leading a whole-of-government effort to understand these tactics, to harden against them, to create deterrence, to create the kind of regulatory environment and legal environment that makes it very, very difficult to do and working with our companies. And instead, I was very pleased to hear Rod Rosenstein outline all that's been going on the justice side. But we certainly know, those of us who were part of the excavation operation in December of 16 of what had happened, that unless the whole government is ordered to work together, you cannot feel and see all parts of the elephant. And without presidential leadership connecting government, intelligence, the companies, the best technical minds in our country, we're not going to do what we need to on this. So that would be my plea, that it's now time for defense of the United States, and not just against Russia. The Chinese are using these techniques, the Iranians are.
And, Tori, you touched on this a little bit about what's happening in, domestically in Russia. You know, Putin raising the retirement age, which has caused his approval rating to take a hit, even though it was rolled out on the first day of the World Cup on purpose to kind of get it in under the positive PR, the raising of the taxes. And, Nina, you were just in Moscow for the World Cup. What does Russia look like from the inside now? What is the domestic situation?
Well, the domestic situation is actually better than we say it is here, because economy is not doing the greatest, but it's actually done quite well, because what Putin did invest, not necessarily for the people's benefit, but for the enriching of his own people, but somehow it trickled down, sort of trickled down economics. They build bridges, they build roads. I personally traveled on the Kalama Highway, which was used to be a road, exactly, used to be a road where inmates during Gulag time were dying on the side of it, and now it's an incredible highway as if you are in Germany. So that's something that also bring money into the state's coffers, because Putin is a big man project, kind of. That's what Trump also likes about him. The bridges, the Crimean Bridge just finished, which also brought economy sort of some benefits. But also something that Putin did out of spite, of course, is counter-sanctions to the Western sanctions, is that mostly agricultural products were prevented from traveling into Russia, and that gave Russia an unexpected boost in actually developing its own agriculture after 1,000 years of trying to do that. So this is something that works. It's not probably a long-term solution. Obviously, they needed to be other things, but for now it works. As for the very unpopular pension reform, they did think that unveiling it on the World Cup day, it's going to kind of die down. Interestingly enough, the people who are pension age, they're not necessarily that interested in the World Cup. They're slightly older, slightly less available to go to the fan zones. So that's where the supports that
but they're
supports
already, they already have their pensions now.
Well, they already have their pensions. Well, but the ones that are coming up. But what just sort of very briefly, what I found really remarkable that during the World Cup, it was Moscow like I've never seen before. I mean, we are not happy people. We don't look happy. there is an expression, a grumpy Russian, and it's really not in vain.
How funny is that? The acknowledgement that they're so unhappy. We don't look happy. We don't act happy. That's hilarious.
So, but that was the remarkable moment when suddenly Russians forgot that there is America or Europe is out to get them. And the joke in Moscow was that Russia had more Catholics in the country since 1812. 1812, as you remember, when the French and Napoleonic Wars, when the French went into Russia, and Russia is Russian Orthodox, and Putin actually built his popularity on separating Russian Orthodoxy from the rest of Christianity, because, of course, ours is a religion of soul. So suddenly all these things were forgotten, and people were mingling, and the volunteers. So it became Putin did get the game. He did build the infrastructure. I mean, they really arranged it very, very well. I must give credit to all the cities. The fan zones were organized. Suddenly the trains were running on time. Everything was doing very well. And it became not Putin's game, despite all of this. Suddenly it became the people's game. Suddenly people felt that they don't need to invade Crimea. They don't need to put on some new missiles to threaten the world. They actually just need to be hospitable. And they took pride in that being, in that incredible hospitality. And all these volunteers and the train conductors, and they were the ones who hosted the World Cup. And I think that actually, Carnegie Moscow did a wonderful work on that. There are a few articles on the subject talking about this, how this is actually a possibility to finally democratize Russia from the bottom. It's no longer from the top. And then people feel that you don't need to win anything. You just have to give in order to take, and then you can become a normal country, something that Russia always wants but never gets because the military muscle gets in the way.
Yeah, you said it reminded you of the 1950s.
Right. I mean, it's too long ago, but when 1957, when Stalinism fell and Stalin died in 53, I mean, you're now all brushed up on this, I know, because of the death of Stalin. So, yes, Stalin died in 53, 56. Nikita Khrushchev denounces Stalinism. In 57, he opens Moscow to the rest of the world. It was the Festival of Youth and youth and culture, and suddenly the world came to the Soviet Union in 57, and that was the feeling. I mean, I wasn't there, but that was described to me, that in 57 the Soviets, the Moscovites, felt that they are part of the world, and that really created that atmosphere of the following reforms that we now know as the thaw.
But this is terrific. I mean, if in fact we have a Russia of hope rather than a Russia of grievance.
That's
and a
I
Russia
felt.
From the bottom rather than being fed. That's a Russia we can work with. And that's the Russia we hoped for in the 90s, that it would be excited to knit into the liberal world. You know, it's just not been Putin style. So that's encouraging.
And it really has not been. I mean, it was the parties that were, but somebody was smart enough to tell the bar keepers, don't close it, because often in Russia, the first response, you can't do it. So here, the first response, they were told, you can't do everything.
So if I could just play the John McLaughlin card of saying, like, oh, it's worse than you think.
Oh, is it a magic? Wait, is it a magic card?
Yeah,
though?
You know, I mean, the political logic of Putin's regime, though, is we are surrounded by enemies, and by unifying and defending ourselves against these foreign threats, we will not be brought back to the low point of the 1990s. And the question is,
one of the things you'll hear, I think, from here on out till it ends, is how low the 1990s are viewed by Russians, right? The whole Soviet Union, the end of the Soviet Union, the whole period of quote-unquote democracy, is viewed by Russians as a horrible period of time in their history. And again, I not just by Russian political types, but when you hear, I think it's Khrushchev's granddaughter talks about it here in a minute or so. Very interesting to me.
Putin, after becoming a war president after 2012 and then more intensely after 2014 with the war in Ukraine, he stopped governing in terms of domestic policy. So they have these big domestic unaddressed political challenges and economic challenges like pension reform, which Tori has mentioned a couple times. But they don't have the sort of policy apparatus or the will to make big changes because they're all thinking ahead, you know, we're going to have to eventually have some kind of leadership transition here, whether it's 10 years from now or whatever. And I think it really makes you think, well, what can they do? Because they had not, you know, they basically wasted a great period of time when Russia could have built its economy around other things other than its natural resources. So it's Russia's kind of stuck. And, you know, I think they're not running out of money. I think they pull things out of the ground and they sell it for dollars, and then they have ruble-denominated domestic liabilities. So they can basically sequester their way through a lot of their problems as long as oil prices aren't $10 or $15 a barrel.
Yeah, it just feels kind of more stagnant than in the past. Before we go to questions, just really quickly from each of you, I'd like to hear, you know, what are the lessons learned from 2016, what we learned about Russian interference, and what can we do with that? Because to some extent, the response has been a bit self-defeating. You know, people rage at Trump and try to get him to condemn Russia. That just infuriates his base and gets him to line up behind him and dismiss the Russian threat. There's sanctions, and there's even people like Daniel Fried are, you know, not sure that they totally work. So, you know, going forward, what should we do about 2016? What are the lessons learned? Start with Toria.
Well, I have done some testimony on this before the Senate Intel Committee. I think we, as I said, need a whole-of-government, presidentially-led initiative that looks at a full-spectrum strategy. First of all, deterrence, drawing on our arms control experience, you know, demonstrating what we can do and that the cost will be too high for the adversary. Regulation. Companies obviously having difficulty self-regulating, even having difficulty sharing information about what they know. There has to be a safe space created by government where we can talk about what a floor of regulation looks like, and then the legal tools and starting to set forward a set of norms. At the same time, that you have to use opportunities like a summit to make absolutely clear to guys like Vladimir Putin and perhaps Xi Jinping in the future that if you do this again, there will be far harsher consequences, ideally in the economic realm, than you felt before. You have to present that hard, hard deterrent. It has to cost for folks to do it. But we also have to educate the American public so that they can understand what is real and what is not real and when they're being manipulated, and also to harden their own personal systems. And that's a big, big job, and it needs presidential leadership.
Three quick things. The U.S. withdrawal from the world stage and the blowing up of our alliances, that is the strength with which you deter and constrain a more assertive Russia. We're basically asleep at the switch or willfully dismantling all of that. Two is exposing and talking about what is going on and being honest about it should give you some strength. But in fact, we've seen politicians, not just Donald Trump, who embrace a lot of these tactics, who push a lot of the same sort of untruth on unwitting publics. That has to stop. Or if it doesn't, people have to be held accountable for that. And then three is, I think we need to be thinking ahead, because what, you know, was done in 2016 in the United States was pretty clunky. It wasn't like the most sneaky covert operation in history. It's the most successful, I'd say, covert operation in recorded history, but it certainly wasn't the sneakiest. Things are going to change. Technology is going to advance. This is not a static problem.
Nina?
Very quickly, I think the diplomatic corps needs to be rebuilt. I think the relationship suffered and struggled and all this. I understand this sending out the diplomats, but I think that's how relationship actually move forward on a level that is not just Putin and Trump. The same thing for people like Victoria, that level of state officials, the State Department officials, really need to talk to the Russian counterparts. Whatever these two people do, we need this relationship, because that's how I think you said that we need this kind of rail, guardrails.
And to remind, in the last year of the Obama administration, I did 7 rounds of talks on Ukraine with Putin's designated.
And they should not, it should not be stopped. Absolutely. Right. And one last thing, I think that the summit is a wonderful thing. I mean, the meeting in the fall, let Putin come in, let him to, try to look everybody in the eyes. In fact, I believe that the intelligence community should have a big meeting with Putin, broadcast everywhere, ask him questions, and let him stare these people down. And, you know, hopefully Trump will get some sort of briefing, and let America have Putin on its own terms and confront him on American own terms.
That is very optimistic. Okay, let's go to some questions. Pam, right there.
I read this morning that the Russians had sold all their treasury debt.
Now, the panel isn't well informed on this, but the question that she's going to ask about Russia divesting of their treasury debt is, in fact, absolutely true. Reuters reported it last week.
In the last couple of months, and converted the debt to Euro sovereign debt and Chinese debt. What do they know, or what does Putin know that we don't know about our markets financially, economically, and politically? What's coming up?
I haven't seen that, but I'd be surprised.
Bloomberg reported it.
Yeah, but I think if you're if you're long dollars, which Russia is naturally by virtue of what it sells on international markets, basically diversifying out of U.S. denominated assets seems kind of maladroit.
Well, they have no debt now, no treasury debt.
I would add to that if they are worried about what response we might give to 2018 midterm manipulation, the strongest remaining cards we have in our arsenal have to do with, Russia's access to the dollar economy, so they may be worried about getting out while they can.
Sir?
First, I just have a clarifying comment and then a question. When we come back to the issue of what role has been played by our country in possible interference in foreign elections, I am under the impression that in 1996, when there was a presidential race in Russia, and a strong communist threat against Boris Yeltsin, that there was massive intervention on the part of our country in trying to see Yeltsin get reelected. But let me just come to my question, which is the first question that you sort of asked is, what is behind this friendship, this sort of romance between sort of Trump and Putin? And I don't think it can necessarily be laid entirely to this personality, this sort of affinity of personality, because if you
we have limited time, so get to your question.
I apologize. So the question is whether or not the Trump approach in terms of Russia, and I'm not condoning it in any way, is in a way another form of triangulation, where actually Trump is trying to split the Chinese and the Russians.
Well, then he's doing a really bad job.
Yeah.
It seems.
Anybody want to clarify on 1996? Because that's not quite right.
And I would like to.
Yeah, I mean, having been in government at that time, we, as we often do, made clear that we had a good working relationship with Yeltsin, that we were concerned that if the communist opposition was elected, that you'd have a complete revanche back to Soviet-style rule before there'd been a chance for the people's will to try democracy, that the clock would be turned back, but that's a completely different matter than running our own advertisements with the Russian public or trying to influence voters' choices or putting money into the thing or hacking and release or any of the rest of this stuff. So it's not equivalent to
also, at all. Also, the if I may, there was a thumb put on the scale of that election, but it was a decidedly Russian thumb. It was the oligarchs. It was the journalists. It was more domestic than foreign, far more. Next question. Ma'am?
Great panel. So I wanted to get your thoughts on the broader Russian attack on democracy and democratic institutions beyond elections, and whether you think we are running the risk of taking too narrow a view and picking up on some of the comments that you made about Putin's insecurities, the small man complex, but also having stated that the fall of the Soviet Union was the worst thing to ever happen in Russia's history, which I think is pretty remarkable given
world history,
how horrible Russia's history has been in various times, and the threat that he feels, and I'm asking, from the concept of democracy with regard to his own population, and then your comments about the fact that he uses techniques honed in Russia elsewhere, the kind of messaging that he's given to his own population about the failure of democracy, not just that Americans are idiots, but that their democracy is a farce. Do you think that he saw in polling results with declining support for democracy a real opportunity to come here and sow skepticism about impartial justice, for example, and the flaws of our judicial system and other democratic institutions? Does that seem likely to you?
Thank you.
To me, that's a very big question. Thank you. I think it's more than just he saw the flaw. I think the 1990s, whatever we think of them, they were chaotic. And if in the Russian view, if that was a democracy, we don't want it. So this is something to remember. This is 90% of the Russians would tell you that that kind of chaotic capitalism really does not work for the country. So that's one part. So in this sense, Putin is not necessarily that original in Russia. Democracy is a curse word, and for a long time, and now people forgot about it, but they used to call it dermokratia, which was shitocracy. So that's how democracy was seen. Yes. Sorry. Have to wash my mouth. just translating. So this is one part. Another part, I think it's also a longer process, and I'm absolutely not in moral equivalency business in any way, but I think what happened with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan really did kind of showed the world that, you know, you should be, if you look at the United States, it's not always the force of good. And so for Putin, that was what he does for him is a continuation of something that he sees already happened in America, the sort of democratic autocrats, you know, on the part of with Dick Cheney, that we do what we want because we protect national security. So Putin comes next, then Erdogan comes next in Turkey, then Xi Jinping. So I think it's a global phenomenon in some way that this democratic autocracies, I mean democratic, I mean that they are technically democratically elected. So he is probably ahead of this, but he's not original in this. He's just the man, as Erdogan recently pointed out, you know, Putin and I, we've been around for so long, we are the statements of the world, and I think Xi Jinping is the third one. So, yes, I think it is a big danger, and I think democracy should do what George Kennan used to say, that he wrote an article in Foreign Affairs in 1996, which was called An American Principle. So America should follow its own principles. And when don't give Putin an opportunity to say, you are hypocritical. You do things that you tell me not to do.
All right. Last question. Sir.
Very simple. What's the succession plan? Putin is not going to live forever. What does Russia look like post-Putin? Is it someone from the kleptocracy? What do you guys think about what
that's a good
looks
question.
Like?
Well, I don't expect Putin will abide by the constitutional requirement to step down at the end of his term in 2024. So we're looking at something that looks more like becoming Grand Ayatollah, where he'll just, you know, be father of the nation until he decides, you know, he no longer wants to. He doesn't have an exit. Like, there's no easy way for him to hand off power. And I think that was the lesson of Dmitry Medvedev's interregnum. The problem is, and this sort of to make it more meta, is there's now an entire generation of people for whom their formative experience is this period of confrontation with the West, who have built a kind of mindset that's antagonistic and that sees us as a threat and feels that, you know, their best days were Russia's activities in Europe and Ukraine and our election in Syria. And so I think we're going to have a whole cohort of people, especially in the national security realm, who are now maybe lieutenant colonels or colonels, who are going to be with us for the next several decades. And it's from their ranks that presumably a successor will emerge. But everything in Russia, we find out about it when it's announced. Like, there's not a lot of advance notice. Mm-hmm. It's largely a black box decision making when it comes to leadership.
Actually, I think we have time for one more. That was so short. Also, just while we're waiting for the mic, I just have to add to that, to what Andrew said. There's also the kind of the idea of confrontation with the West being a good thing also grows out of the chaos of the 90s and the denigration that Russians felt. And what I hear when I go to Moscow from people who are close to the Kremlin is, you know, they used to mock us, now they fear us. I mean, we'd rather be loved than hated, but if it's between being mocked and being feared and hated, we'd take the latter.
Can I actually just add to this, though? That's not what I saw in the World Cup. And I was actually thinking how unsuccessful Putin's propaganda is, that the West is to blame. I also, last year, I went through across all of Russia's 11 time zones to see what Russia is actually like. And let me tell you that the only animosity that I felt, because I was traveling with an American colleague, was in Kaliningrad, which is on the border with Germany. And the rest of Russia, how does America live? Oh, my God. That's what I think. Diplomacy is so important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, let's do this real quick.
It's a yes or no question.
Perfect.
Dan Coates demurred when Andrea Mitchell asked him the following question, which I'll ask the panel. Was the Trump-Putin meeting recorded?
I'm going to guess yes.
I hope the U.S. side has a tape.
Nina?
Yeah. Hopefully.
All right. With that, we're going to wrap this up. Thank you all so much. Thank you to our wonderful panelists.
Interesting stuff. You know, smart people that have made Russia, studying Russia their whole life and moving the kaleidoscope. I enjoy it tremendously. You know, and I'm sure depending where you sit on the political spectrum, some of that angers you, some of it doesn't, some of it heartens you. But I thought it was very interesting, just the broader discussion about Russia, where it is economically, how it has honed the tools that it chooses against the United States in terms of influence wars, how they've been honed inside the Soviet Union, used on their neighbors, and now they're coming to a theater near you. So I, if you can't tell, I enjoy those discussions incredibly. We'll take a quick break. We'll get the Gunner on. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.